Today is July 31st, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Macro Observer. In the next 8 to 10 minutes, we'll cover Ukraine's Caspian Sea strikes on Iranian-linked vessels, which appear to be merging the Russia war and the U.S.-Iran Gulf conflict into a single system, along with Washington's pivot to Section 301 and 338 tariff authorities and the Senate's advancing Russia sanctions bill. On July 25th, Ukrainian forces hit something no belligerent in this war had touched before— assets tied to a third state entirely outside the Russia-Ukraine conflict. President Zelensky announced strikes on the Beghi and the Port Olya, too, vessels flying Russian flags but, according to Zelensky, carrying Iranian military cargo, along with an unnamed warship in the Caspian Sea. The same night, Ukrainian forces struck the Tyumen oil refinery in Yekaterinburg, a fuel depot in Rostov-on-Don, and a weapons plant in Kirov, at a range of roughly 1,200 kilometers. Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, called it a violation of the UN Charter, claimed it was carried out at Israel's behest, alleged a sailor was killed, and said it, quote, cannot go unanswered. Ukraine's response has been, frankly, contradictory. Foreign Minister Andriy Sybiha publicly branded Tehran a direct accomplice to Russian aggression since 2022, while separately assuring Iranian officials the strike was unintentional, and that Kyiv isn't seeking escalation. Strategic calculus here, according to Telegraph diplomatic editor Joe Barnes, is that Ukraine wants Washington to see the Russia war and the Iran conflict as inseparable. That's not incidental timing. It lands right before Zelensky's July 28th meetings with President Trump. Zelensky has also alleged that Russia supplied Iran with satellite imagery used to help target four U.S. allied Gulf air bases surveyed in mid-July across Bahrain, Jordan, and Kuwait. If that claim gains traction in Washington, it hardens U.S. posture toward Moscow and Tehran simultaneously, rather than treating them as separate files. More importantly, Iran's economic position was already buckling before this strike landed. Oil exports have fallen to under one-sixth of pre-war levels, a six-year low creating roughly a $6 billion shortfall. Non-oil trade with China collapsed 75% year-on-year, from $3.3 billion to just $830 million between March and June of this year. Gulf neighbor trade, which made up 51% of Iran's non-oil exports last year, has fallen to near zero as Gulf states halt purchases. On top of that, the U.S. Hormuz counter-blockade, Operation Epic Fury, is estimated to be costing Iran $500 million a day. The Caspian Shadow Fleet route was one of Iran's last remaining lifelines to Russia, and it's now directly under threat, which raises the odds of asymmetric retaliation. One low-confidence report suggests IRGC-linked circles are weighing a deniable ballistic missile strike on Kyiv. Treat that as speculation, not policy, but it's worth watching. Historically, this rhymes with the tanker war phase of the Iran-Iraq conflict in the 1980s, when both sides targeted merchant shipping in the Gulf and eventually drew outside navies into the fight. The shifting geography of power here shows two previously separate conflict maps, one centered on Ukraine, one centered on the Gulf, beginning to overlap at a single choke point, the Caspian Sea. On the economic front, Washington is diversifying its tariff toolkit after the Supreme Court struck down IEEPA-based emergency tariffs and Section 122 authority expired on July 24th. CSIS analysts Angela Ellard and Phil Levy describe a shift towards Section 301 forced labor tariffs of 10 to 12.5%, now covering 60 countries and 86 jurisdictions, approximately 99% of U.S. trade. Building on that, a 50% Section 338 tariff on Canada, a provision unused since the 1930s, takes effect August 19th, and a 25% Section 301 tariff on Brazil already took effect on July 20th. Separately, the Senate voted 86-12 to advance the Graham-Blumenthal-Russia sanctions bill, which would let the president impose tariffs up to 500% on Russia itself and up to 100% on the top five importers of Russian oil and gas. China and India by far the largest, followed by Slovakia, Hungary, and Azerbaijan. The strategic calculus here, per Levy, is that stacking Section 232, 301, and now 338 authorities together may approach the scope of the tariff power the courts just invalidated. Slower to deploy, more exposed to litigation, but redundant enough to survive a judicial setback. That redundancy sustains what both analysts call a de facto 10% global tariff floor. And the numbers driving the China and India piece are stark. China's 2025 exports to the U.S. totaled $308.4 billion, India's $103.8 billion, both dwarfing Russia's own Kremlin forecast $113.7 billion in total oil and gas revenue for this year. That's a brutal cost-benefit equation for Beijing and New Delhi, even accounting for their reluctance to bend on strategic autonomy. More importantly, Levy doesn't think that 100% tariff lever against China and India will actually get pulled. The administration has grown gun-shy on China tariffs since the rare earth supply scare. The bill's real significance may be quieter. It would codify thousands of existing Russia sanctions currently resting on executive orders alone, which forecloses a future president's ability to unilaterally trade them away in a deal with Moscow. And the Section 338 precedent against Canada, triggered by provincial liquor shelf policy, not a national grievance, sets a notably low evidentiary bar that could become a template against other allies down the road. Inside Russia, the war is being institutionalized rather than treated as an emergency. At his July 27th meeting with State Duma lawmakers, Putin confirmed defense funding will remain the top three-year budget priority through 2029. That's a shift from wartime improvisation to structured, long-term war financing. The same week, Zelensky warned that Russia is preparing to forcibly draft up to 500,000 additional soldiers, likely in early October, timed around the September 18th to 20th Duma elections, the first time in nearly two decades that United Russia is campaigning jointly with Putin himself. Duma Defense Committee Chair Andrei Kartopolov dismissed the claim, but corroborating legislation reportedly gives the defense ministry access to a 2-million-strong reserve force and to Russia's civil registry data. The strategic calculus here is that Putin is signaling to his own population and to the West that Russia intends to outlast Western political cycles rather than negotiate under pressure. But that posture sits awkwardly next to real strain. Russian oil refining capacity has hit a 21-year low, the budget deficit is running around $77 billion, and polling from the Institute of Conflictology and Analysis of Russia found 81% of Russians want an immediate end to the war, with 73% opposed to a second mobilization wave. Putin's own approval rating, per Russia's own state-aligned pollster, sat at 65.1% on July 20th, a low point for the year. More importantly, Ukraine's deep strike campaign is compounding that pressure. Cumulative damage is estimated at $6.1 billion across 697 targets as of July 10th, with strike frequency up 1,150% since the start of this year. A strike on Russia's Wildberries logistics network destroyed roughly 10% of its warehouse stock, meaning 90% is still standing and likely still a target. Nearly 200 Shadow Fleet vessels have been hit across the Black Sea, the Sea of Azov, and the Caspian in the past month alone. Zelensky has also alleged North Korea is negotiating to send 30,000 soldiers and missile launchers to Russia, with facilities reportedly being prepared in the Voronezh region, a development that would internationalize Russia's manpower crisis and hand Pyongyang combat-tested missile improvements. Historically, this echoes the September 2022 mobilization of 300,000 reservists, which triggered mass protests and an exodus of draft-age men, even when war support was comparatively strong. A call-up roughly 65% larger, arriving amid far deeper fatigue and economic strain, points toward a more severe domestic reaction this time. A few regional signals worth flagging quickly. The U.S.-Iran confrontation, now in its sixth month, is spilling past its original borders. Jordan intercepted 5 missiles fired from Iran. Egyptian officials reported a drone-sparked fire at a Mediterranean port, and a Kuwaiti strike killed a worker at a facility used by a Chinese company, introducing a great power casualty dimension to what had been a regional dispute. In Europe, Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk confirmed a suspected Russian cruise missile exploded in Lublin province, about 55 miles from the Ukrainian border. An echo of the 2022 Przywodów incident, where NATO moved cautiously rather than invoking Article 5. The EU, meanwhile, is preparing its largest sanctions package of the war, covering over 1,600 companies with combined turnover exceeding $20 billion, though Bloomberg notes it still likely won't match the bite of earlier oil and banking restrictions. And in the Indo-Pacific, the shifting geography of power extends into AI. China's Moonshot AI released Kimi K3, a 2.8 trillion parameter open weight model that jumped from 15th to 3rd place on the artificial analysis leaderboard, trailing only Claude and GPT-class systems. A sign, Beijing has made open model diffusion explicit state policy, with real implications for U.S. export controls. Over the next 48 hours, the single clearest signal to watch is whether Zelensky's Washington meetings produce a concrete anti-ballistic defense commitment from President Trump, or dissolve into the same rhetorical pattern seen before. If Iran responds to the Caspian strikes with anything resembling a confirmed ballistic action against Kyiv, that formalizes the merger of the Ukraine and Gulf conflicts in real time, and that's the tripwire this entire briefing has been circling. Stay vigilant. Until tomorrow. That's your core brief for today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more.